As Britain watches a deeply volatile conflict between Israel, the United States, Iran and other parts of the Middle East, Keir Starmer finds himself in a major foreign policy test, and his instincts are as closely scrutinised as his domestic polling. Starmer has taken this quite cautious law-first approach, refusing to commit the UK to offensive strikes on Iran and insisting that British military action must be lawful and clearly in the national interest. That stance has drawn sharp rebukes from US President Donald Trump and critics at home who argue he's wobbling under pressure.
By the way, I'm not happy with the UK either, so we are very surprised. This is not Winston Churchill that we're dealing with.
But behind this modern dilemma is a long shadow, the legacy of Tony Blair and the Iraq War, whose legal and strategic controversies still shape how Labour approaches military intervention. So today we're asking, is Starmer's stance on Iran defined by principle or just by a fear of repeating the mistakes of Blairism? It's News Talk Daily, I'm Ciara Doherty. And Tony Blair became the youngest British Prime Minister of the 20th century after Labour won a landslide victory in the 1997 general election in the UK. Some of his successes included the introduction of a national minimum wage, devolution in Scotland and Wales, and of course the Good Friday Agreement. However, his premiership was also marred by his support of the illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003. Blair has the odd distinction of being amongst the most popular and unpopular politicians in British history. As Prime Minister, he achieved the highest recorded approval ratings in his first term, but one of the lowest after the Iraq War. So, what is his legacy today and how does it continue to shape and influence the Labour Party and Keir Starmer?
We believe that the best way forward for the region and for the world is a negotiated settlement in which Iran agrees to give up any aspirations to develop a nuclear weapon and ceases its destabilising activity across the region. That has been the long-standing position of successive British governments. President Trump has expressed his disagreement with our decision not to get involved in the initial strikes, but it is my duty to judge what is in Britain's national interest. That is what I've done, and I stand by it. To be clear, the use of British bases is limited to the agreed defensive purposes. We are not joining the US and Israeli offensive strikes. The basis for our decision is the collective self-defence of long-standing friends and allies and protecting British lives. It is in accordance with international law, and we've produced a summary of our legal advice which clearly sets this out. Mr. Speaker, we all remember the mistakes of Iraq, and we have learned those lessons. Any UK actions must always have a lawful basis and a viable thought-through plan.
Well, joining me to discuss this is Glenn O'Hara. Glenn is a professor of modern and contemporary history at Oxford Brookes University and author of New Labour, New Britain, How the Blair Governments Reshaped the Country. Glenn, you are very welcome to News Talk Daily. I was so interested to watch Keir Starmer this week and his approach to what has been happening in the Middle East, in particular in Iran. And I really thought the shadow of Tony Blair has been looming over the Labour Party for decades for many reasons. But you could really see it in Technicolor this week, couldn't you, with Keir Starmer and the position that he took?
Yes, because the Blair years are always going to have that fatal word hung round them of Iraq and the second Gulf War, aren't they? And Starmer's kind of defining himself slightly against what Blair did. What did he say? He said, we don't believe in regime change from the air. And he separated himself from the Americans in a way that Blair decided, I think, quite early on that he wasn't going to get separate. He was going to stick with George W. Bush through thick and thin and try and influence him, but stick with the Americans. And Keir Starmer is a very different person. He's much more careful. He's much more lawyerly. He's much less fervent when he spots a cause. He proceeds at much more caution, doesn't he? And partly that's about his experience, I think, of opposing the Iraq war. You're right.
I mean, the phrase that he used very clearly was, we're going to avoid the mistakes of Iraq. He said that in the House of Commons, which were clearly made under Tony Blair's Labour Party. Give me a sense of how widely that has haunted or indeed damaged the party over the last couple of decades.
I think it has damaged it with, I think you could broadly say, left-leaning Britons, people who are now leaning over to the Greens, who maybe at the time over Iraq lent over towards the Liberal Democrats under Charles Kennedy. And the Lib Dems got nearly a quarter of the vote in 2005 after Iraq. And so it damaged him with people on the left, but it damaged him with all sorts of voters, Blair. And it took the lustre off that kind of almost ready-break glow that he had of being politically untouchable, being a bit like Reagan, really, in America, that he was kind of the Teflon leader that you just couldn't get at. It knocked all that away, and Labour's been left with that ever since. And that, to some extent, was why they elected Ed Miliband and why they then elected Jeremy Corbyn, a leader in Miliband who said, well, we're going to move away from Blair. And then a leader in Jeremy Corbyn who said, we're going to completely reject most elements of the Blair settlement or Blair policy. So it really, really has lived with Labour. That said, I think Starmer coming in and being a bit in between those views, kind of he's talked to Blair, he's been seen with Blair, he's not kind of condemned Blair like Corbyn has. That marked a kind of 20 or 25 years since the Blair era. And there was a feeling that Labour could move away from the Blair legacy and the Blair shadow. But this is all, you're absolutely right, this has led to it all coming, all roaring back into the fevered Labour psyche, hasn't it?
Yeah, you mentioned Ed Miliband there, and it's interesting, when he was opposition leader back in 2013, he also voted to block UK military action against the Syrian regime.
That's right, and that's one of the reasons why Keir Starmer is proceeding at more caution than he might have done. You've seen the Australian Prime Minister, the Canadian Prime Minister be more rhetorically in favour of these strikes on Iran. And he could have said, Starmer, couldn't he, we're going to let the bases be used from the start and we back totally the American action. And he definitely hasn't said that. He had to move slowly on using the bases. He said it was defence of Gulf allies that he was doing that for, not quote unquote offensive action, whatever that means. So he's proceeded with much more care, partly to hold his party together. And I think, to be honest, that's slightly working at the moment, isn't it? And Labour MPs are pretty impressed with Starmer's performance. And in comparison to what they see as Blair's mistakes all those years ago.
He did assure MPs that he remembered, as I said, the mistakes of Iraq, that he would always operate, he said, on a lawful basis and with a viable, thought-through plan to the crisis that we've seen erupting in the Middle East. Is the implication here that he doesn't think the US and Israel have a plan?
I think the implication is that he's worried about that and that he hasn't seen one. But of course, he hasn't been in the loop. He's also worried about escalation, the word that Labour always uses and a lot of left people all around the world are using, which is, where is this going? What is the end point? Because we've seen also in some other examples, we don't really need Iraq all the time to say, look at Libya, when there was an intervention against the Gaddafi regime to stop the massacre that would have happened in Benghazi. And then Libya falls to pieces because there isn't a viable plan. Look, we've seen the chaotic retreat from Afghanistan because there wasn't a viable plan of how to build up at least a semi-democratic state and then get out. So there have been lots and lots of examples in front of Starmer that make him think, well, I'm very, very worried about this, where this is going. Because if UK forces get involved in protecting Oman, protecting Bahrain, intercepting drones over Jordan, where next? Are they going to strike the launchers? Are the Iranians going to fire on the British planes? So he's really, really worried about that. And I think also you've got to remember that Keir Starmer is a humanitarian international rights lawyer. That's where he's coming from. So he always looks at the law and he always moves with a kind of almost crab-like step-by-step look at the text. So he's always worried about the words and the text and the implications. He's as I've said earlier, he's just a very different person to Blair.
As you say, Tony Blair was very clear that he was going to align himself with Washington when it came to Iraq, that he was going to align himself with George W. Bush. I think he was called his poodle at one stage, which is insulting, I think, to say the least. Keir Starmer has danced around Donald Trump since he took office, quite successfully, many would say, but we've heard in recent days him really incurring the wrath of Donald Trump. The chokehold again of that Iraq war playing on his mind, clearly. Do you think he's actually really willing to potentially damage that relationship with Washington and with Donald Trump and to ensure that the UK courses the right course of action here?
Yes, I think he is. And I think firstly, the first thing to say is that voters understand that Keir Starmer had to kind of eat it all up standing there next to Donald Trump, and that he couldn't make an open and early break with him. And actually, voters quite admired Starmer for being so restrained and being so diplomatic. And there were wins from that. Britain got a better tariff deal. Britain continued its defence and security cooperation behind the scenes. Britain got the Americans initially to agree to the deal over the Chagos Islands in the Indian Ocean. So there were big wins. And voters said, well, we don't like Donald Trump, but we think that Keir Starmer's probably doing the right thing, because you can't just openly break early on for no reason with the president of the United States. Much as you can see in Starmer's face, he's not the sort of man that he would generally kind of think of as in his tribe. And Donald Trump says the same. You know, he says, well, the guy's a liberal, or he has done, but we get on. But secondly, we've been waiting for this break point, and we've been expecting it to come because they're so different in political culture, in style, you know, in approach, that they were bound to have this row. That said, I think Donald Trump is quite transactional. We've seen him fall out with people. We've seen him viciously attack people and then suddenly get back with them and say what a great guy they are and that they're all beautiful people and they're all getting on. So we might see in the future, for instance, a royal state visit to the US in the near future or the medium term. And then it's all kind of smiles and hugs again. So I think that there will be a break, and I think there will be a row, as there is now. But then the Anglo-American cooperation is so tight and so codependent in, you know, just, you know, lift capacity in defence, that it won't be a total breach and it won't be a complete break.
As you say, position that he has taken here has proved pretty popular with the public. I heard one commentator calling it his Love Actually moment as he stands up to the strength of US and to Donald Trump. And Labour Party and Keir Starmer, he really needed that, particularly, I suppose, if you look at the local election last week where they came third in what was traditionally a really safe seat. They managed to lose, overturn 13,000 votes that they achieved only 18 months ago in the local elections, or the general elections rather. Do you see that as a real shot in the arm for him, something that can have a long-lasting impact on Keir Starmer and the Labour Party?
I think it will have a short-term impact because you're right. By charting a rather different course to Trump, he's definitely gathering support in Labour circles. They've been urging him on to be a bit clearer about this, and that's exactly what he's done. But I think that in the medium to long term, I feel that lots of Labour people have long ago concluded that they probably won't go into the next general election with Keir Starmer as their leader, because he's quite stiff, he's quite starchy. He's not a particular people person, and his political instincts are quite starchy. He seems more of a bureaucrat and an administrator in comparison, again, with Blair, who was the ultimate politician and the ultimate skilled persuader. Bill Clinton said, you know, he could charm the squirrels down out of the trees. Well, Keir Starmer's not going to be charming that many squirrels down out of that many trees with his kind of style. So I think there'll be a short-term boost that will be mainly amongst Labour people, but also amongst the public. We can see 49% in one poll saying that they're against the American action in Iran. But in the long run, if Labour come third in Scotland and Wales in May and they lose hundreds and hundreds of local election seats in England, I don't see this being a complete turnaround in Starmer's future. That said, he is good at foreign policy. He does look good. He does work hard and he does look authoritative. So the more there are international crises, the more that will help him.
So contrast all of this then with the success of Tony Blair when he came in to politics. Mm-hmm. Three consecutive general elections he was able to win for the party under his leadership.
Absolutely. Well, Blair was a very, very different person, as I've just said, and he was, especially early on, someone who garnered just incredible levels of popularity. I was just looking at the numbers last night, and at some points he was up in the 80s percentage, you know, plus 80, and there's Keir Starmer at minus 55, so, or minus 50. So it really is like night and day. Now, partly that style, partly that's being the kind of person who will drink tea out of a mug, not a cup. You know, he'll draw, you know, being a Ford Galaxy, he'll be a kind of call me Tony man of the people. So there's a stylistic ability to that. There's partly just someone who has an X factor of charisma, as your older listeners will remember. Blair certainly had that. But I think it's also that Blair has a political strategy. We can lionize someone who's good at politics like Bill Clinton all we want, but you have to have a strategy. Now, Blair had a thought that Britain had to re-equip itself for globalisation, for a changing world. So Britain had to get better educated. It had to get better infrastructure. It had to get a better public services that worked for people. And Labour's now really, really struggling with all of that because I'm not sure they have an overall strategy. So that's the contrast. It's style, but it's substance too.
OK, so Tony Blair was positive. He was optimistic about the future of Britain. He had, as you say, that charm, that likability factor, it appears, in absolute spades. So that was his personality. But you're saying his policy and his ideology, that was authentic too.
Yes, I think it was. And he'd made his own kind of, I don't know, adapted social democracy, or he would have said, you know, socialism for a modern age, where he'd taken lots of chunks of different bits of thought, a lot of them quite Labour in thought, and he'd said, well, let's apply them to the modern world. Because he did, remember, he did lots of Labour-y things. Now, we remember him as a centrist prime minister, as maybe quite right-leaning on some issues, but what leader had brought in a national minimum wage or tax credits for low-income workers, or had brought in a right to roam on some of England and Wales's land, or brought devolution to Scotland and Wales? So he'd done lots and lots of left-leaning things that Labour had been desperate to do for decades and hadn't been able to do. So he had also this thrust that said, well, look, there's a time of prosperity, there's a time of growth. Government has got some money. Instead of spending it on tax cuts like many states did, instead of spending it on consumption, we should spend it on investment. Now, that's partly what Rachel Reeves is trying to do right now, but she's just less good at communicating that. So strategy and communication go together.
You've written this new book about New Labour, looking at Tony Blair. What prompted you to write that?
Well, I think that we've come a long way. It's 30 years nearly. It'll be 30 years next year since the 1997 election, a fact that makes me feel quite old, because I remember it all, that very bright May morning and all that optimism that people had. So I think as a historian, as a professional historian who teaches at a university, I wanted to say, well, let's have a proper look at the Blair policies. Let's see what succeeded, what didn't succeed, what was quite conservative and authoritarian, like a lot of the crime and justice policies, what was very liberal, like a lot of the social policies, what were the successes and failures, and why were they successes and failures? Because I think we need to look back as historians a lot of the time, like people have looked back at Harold Wilson or Mrs. Thatcher. And no doubt people will look back at David Cameron and Theresa May and say, you know, there were failures and there were at least some successes. So I guess at this passage of time, at this distance of time, we want to look back and say, well, let's take a sober look. Let's put aside you hated him, you loved him, you didn't agree with him, you agreed with him, and have a think more calmly about why did it happen, Blairism and the Third Way, and what were its consequences, and what were its knock-on effects even today?
In Ireland, I think he has a very particular legacy, a very particular reputation because of the Good Friday Agreement. And there is this also series on Channel 4 running at the moment about Tony Blair. And there's a great quote from Mo Mullen within that series that Tony succeeded because he thought he was effing Jesus. Is that your read of it?
Well, as kind of aforementioned sober historian, I think I'd take a slightly more detached view, but I can see where Mo is coming from, because I think that you know, my dad's family are from the north of Ireland, and you can see that from my name. So I'm kind of very interested in Northern Ireland. And sometimes I get a bit annoyed with the kind of high level discussion that of the leaders and Sinn Féin's leaders and David Trimble and the Irish government and the British government, because really peace in Northern Ireland comes from the grassroots. It comes from within Northern Ireland, and the pressure to just say, look, we've had enough, that you can see through all sorts of community groups like the women's movement that win seats at Stormont in the first devolution election. So you've got to really see peace in Northern Ireland coming up from the demand of people in Northern Ireland to say, just stop. This has gone too far, and it's gone on for too long. But on the other hand, that said, I think that particular peace agreement at that particular time and in that particular shape, with all its pluses and minuses, it wouldn't have happened without Blair, but also without Bertie Ahern, of course, and without all of the Irish leaders who took part in that, because of their ability just to bring the leaders together and to work all night and to focus completely on that. And of course, in Blair's case, to bring in Bill Clinton, who does play a role in kind of chairing that and appointing George Mitchell and getting the parties together. So I guess that's a very long-winded academic way of saying yes and no. Blair's very important. He's not the key, but he's very, very important in bringing those people together and deploying that charm and energy and youth and just saying, well, let's start again. Let's start again in 97. But if this collapses again, I'm not going to deal with you, which is what he says to Sinn Féin.
Let's just listen to Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern discussing on the News Talk podcast, as I remember it, Bertie Ahern and the Good Friday Agreement.
As I always say to people, the real test of a leader is whether, not whether you're prepared to say yes to the people supporting you, whether you're prepared to say no. I mean, I had a lot of disagreement within the British system. I mean, I was constantly told, well, the IRA are not really serious about this, you know, they're retaining their ability to go back to violence, and they will, and, you know, this is a tactic, it's not a true commitment. I had to have the conversation at the end to say to them, look, my judgment, I'm making my own judgment because I'm talking to these people. You're bound to take a risk when you do that. You know, you do that and then something terrible happens. People say, well, it's really your responsibility. You got rid of the, you know, the watchtowers and look what's happened. So I think this, one of the themes that runs throughout the whole of what we're talking about here in the peace process is the fundamental idea of leadership that ultimately, it's very hard.
Yeah, well, I think when you look back on 25 years is a good span to look back. And there were only about 10 official crossings during the Troubles. After all those watchtowers and road blockages were removed, Tony, there are now hundreds of crossings. And in the last 20 years, there's been no incidents across these areas. So I think it speaks for itself. I mean, it's the decision speaks for itself.
So if the Good Friday Agreement was his crowning glory, let's look at one of the big failures and the impact I think that had in Britain and trust of government and trust of politics. And that's what happened in the Middle East. Let's just listen to award-winning journalist and author Rania Abouzeid speaking on this show back in October last year about Tony Blair and the Board of Peace.
Tony Blair's legacy, he will forever be stained, and he frankly should be haunted by the blood of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. He is despised in the region. He is considered a war criminal, one who, like George W. Bush and other U.S. officials who were involved in the invasion of Iraq, was never held accountable for destroying a country and for the deaths of so many Iraqis. So his appointment was certainly not welcomed in the region. And I can say that unequivocally across the board.
It's quite the contrast, isn't it?
It is quite the contrast. But I mean, we're looking at and coming to this from different perspectives. So there's me looking at the domestic side and the British side at home, and also the legacy in Northern Ireland. And there's your other speaker talking about, you know, that deep unpopularity, which is absolutely right in lots of the Middle East. And therefore you see in some ways the kind of, I call it the Janus face of New Labour, the two faces of New Labour, the productive side, the optimistic side, the hopeful side that for so long was so popular in Britain. And, you know, among lots of Britons today, I've been surprised at how Blair is not seen by lots of people I've been talking to in the last few weeks as vastly unpopular. And then you've got the foreign policy side, which is seen as that word stained by Iraq. And it will absolutely always be stained by Iraq. And I think Blair knows that. There's that movie, isn't there? The Ghost, about, you know, a very thinly disguised Tony Blair as an ex-prime minister, played by Pierce Brosnan, who's always shadowed by that legacy. You know, the counterfactual is like, if he'd not done Iraq, if he'd pulled out at the last moment, as the Americans offered him, they said, look, you don't have to do this, his legacy would look much more burnished and much more popular. But he had those commitments, and he had that view that he had to make Iraq quote unquote democratic. He had to go after what he thought were weapons of mass destruction, what he said were WMD. And he made that fateful decision. You know, you heard him say about leadership in that interview with Bertie Ahern. He thought that was leadership. He got it wrong, probably, in my view, but he you know, thought at the time it was right. And that's what it is. It is what it is, really.
And that is why the British government at the moment is somewhat faltering, and perhaps there's a real sense of dread about what potentially lies ahead and the decisions they might have to make about the Middle East.
Well, the shadow is that, one of the shadows is that Iran breaks apart, Iran collapses, doesn't have a government properly that can function, that it gets smashed up into ethnic or sectarian war. I mean, it's a much more consistent nation state than Iraq, although I'm no expert in Middle East affairs, so that's less likely than it was in Iraq. But the dread and the nightmare is that you get some sort of post-war collapse. Now, it's worth saying that I think that the way the Trump administration functions is to go in, get some of what it wants, declare victory, disappear. So that's why they say no boots on the ground, no nation building, you know, no, what did Hesketh call it? No stupid rules of engagement. They're not going to try and run Iran. They're not going to try and govern Iran or reshape Iran. So there's less danger of that, because they're hardly idealists. They just want some Iranian hard man to emerge and who they can make do what they want, like they've done in Venezuela. So that there is less danger of that, but the danger is not zero. And that's what worries Keir Starmer. Well, what really moves Keir Starmer is the idea of the law, the idea of being consistent with the law and upholding what he would call an international rules-based order. And that's why he moves very slowly, step by step, in a way that, you know, more charismatic leaders like Blair didn't and wouldn't. But maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a kind of person for our times.
Glenn O'Hara, thank you so much for joining us here on News Talk Daily. Really appreciate your insights and your time. And Glenn's new book is called New Labour, New Britain, and it offers a nuanced and, I think, fairly balanced reappraisal of New Labour government's policies and their impact on British society. Thanks for your time.
Well, thanks for having me. That was great. Bye.
Well, that's it from us on the podcast today. You can listen back to every episode of News Talk Daily on the Go Loud player. But for now, from me, Ciara Doherty, take care.